Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three. It's been a few weeks off over the school holidays, and this is also a bit of a late addition in the week. I've been away at a conference and intensive at Moreland College, where I still am a part-time faculty member. And so I've been in a class on preaching Hebrews, both delivering and learning. We had Dr. David De Silva, who's written over 40 books and all sorts of articles on the New Testament. And he was taking us through Hebrews, and I was doing a bunch of work around the preaching of Hebrews. So it was great, but a little bit late in the week for me to be releasing the Big Three. It's also the first Big Three that we've done in the current series, and we've got one more week coming up. So we're kind of dropping in a little bit late in the piece, but it's our series, A Great Cloud of Witnesses, where we're looking at five faithful women. And last Sunday, I preached on the character of Hagar and the role that she plays in the story of God, what we learn about God in terms of how he sees the one who is invisible and knows her name and hears her misery and invites her to participate. And for her part, she seems to take the opportunity to live theologically, to live in light of the God who sees and hears and invites. And so a handful of questions came in over the course of the week. I was actually not planning to do a Big Three. And then at this intensive, at one point, it came up that, you know, we do this thing to kind of help people engage differently. And someone asked how we did it. And so I jumped onto Linktree and hit the Big Three button and said to them, listen, there won't be any questions in it because, you know, we haven't promoted it this week. And as it opened up, I saw the questions. So thank you to those of you who sent them in. It was great to see them, and apologize for this being a bit late. But the three questions that came out of that sermon were these. How, as Christians, do we maintain our faithfulness to God in trusting him to fulfill his promises without taking matters into our own hands like Abram and Sarah? Which is, I think, you know, we focused on Hagar's character, but ultimately this is the big question for Abram and Sarah, right? They took matters into their own hands. It had some pretty hectic consequences to some degree, but how do we avoid that? How do we maintain that faithfulness? That's a great question. Secondly, given Exodus 33:11, is this one of the Old Testament appearances of Jesus? And I'm assuming that that's in relationship to the angel of the Lord who meets Hagar at the well. And so that's how I'm going to answer that question. So I apologize if I've got that wrong. And then third, does Galatians 3:16 change how we understand the blessings given to Hagar? And so when we get to that question, I'll bring up the text so you have some context for that as well. So let's get stuck in. So as I said, the first question, while not explicitly about Hagar, is certainly, I think, a critical question in the story of Hagar and Ishmael. How, as Christians, do we maintain our faithfulness to God in trusting him to fulfill his promises without taking matters into our own hands like Abram and Sarah? And I reckon that there's a real tension to be held here. This is not a biblical proverb, but there is something to it, right? God helps those who help themselves, right? Not a biblical proverb, but there's something about it that kind of resonates with us, right? The whole idea of just passively waiting for God to show up and never doing anything strikes us, and I think appropriately so, as not really what we're called to, right? What's that story? It was a flood, and a man had climbed onto the roof of his house, and the waters kept rising, and, you know, someone passed on a small boat, canoe, and said, you know, do you want to get in? And he said, no, it's okay. God's going to save me. And a motorboat goes past a little bit later on. They said, do you want to get in the boat? And he said, no, God will save me. And finally a helicopter comes past and says, do you want us to winch you up? And he says, no, God's going to save me. And then the water raises up over the roof and he dies. And he gets to heaven and says to God, why didn't you save me? And God says, well, I sent you the canoe and the motor boat in the helicopter. Like, I don't know what else we want to do for you. And that sense of that passive, God will just take care of it, doesn't strike us as being an effective way forward. Like, it seems that God does invite us, right, to participate in what he's doing. There are things that we are called to do and ways that we are meant to kind of be looking for his hand in the world and all those sorts of things. And so Abram and Sarah, I think, are a good demonstration of kind of not getting caught, but being caught in the tension between there are things that we can do and things that we cannot do. So they end up kind of stepping outside of God's power, and really, I suppose, God's faithfulness, and promise. Now in the story, I think importantly, the Lord has not yet said to Abram that the offspring will be through Sarai. Now, to be fair, I think that the plan was that Abram would not have gone outside of that plan, right? That he would have stayed within the bounds of marriage as God had ordained it. You know, one man and one wife, right? And one man and one woman. That a man will leave his mother and his father and be united with his wife and they'll become one flesh. And that was the kind of the only option, shall we say, that God was planning for until Hagar steps in, or Sarah brings Hagar in, is a better way to put it. Utilizing the legal and social conventions of the day. So how we balance up our activity and God's activity, I think, is a really critical one. So I think there are a handful of things that we learn from this story that I think are worth paying attention to. One is that we have to be very, very clear that what we seek to do to help God or to participate, probably a better way to say it, is to participate in his promises, right? And we need to make sure that we are, that our participation is completely above board. The author of the story does not explicitly state that Abram taking Hagar as his wife was doing the wrong thing. But the way the story is told, we get the impression pretty clearly, you know, not only with the parallels to Genesis chapter 3 in the fall, but also just in the outcomes for the family. Like, they just weren't great. And so I think we have to be really certain that our actions and our activities are above board. I think that's one of the first things. I think a second thing that we can do is, when we become impatient, because I think that's the problem, right? The promise of God for Abram was a pressing one. Time was not on his side and his wife's side. And so there was this growing sense of impatience, and that impatience led to problem solving. It's striking. This coming Sunday, we're going to hear about Rebecca's life. And Rebecca and Isaac struggle to have kids too, but they go to God. Isaac prays, and the Lord responds, and the Lord has spoken to Abraham, and so there's a sense that Abraham and Sarah don't go to the Lord and say, "Listen, we're running out of patience, or we're running out of time, or we don't think that this is going to work, or you know we've doing some thinking, and what do you think about the Hagar solution, right?" They don't go to God. They just kind of solve it on their own, and I think that's problematic. So when we are tempted to kind of try to bypass or hurry up God's plans, I think that can be a place where we have to be pretty careful. And I think, to sustain ourselves in our impatience, we need people to help us remember the ways that God has been faithful. We need to remember the ways that God has in the past come through. And so I think whether that's other people helping us do that, or whether do we just take some time to recall the promises and the goodness of God that helps us to wait, is helpful. And I think, you know, big picture, I think we probably also need some wisdom in this space, right? To some degree, that's the first thing that popped into my head when I saw this question, because wisdom is about doing the right thing at the right time, or saying the right thing at the right time. And I think as followers of Jesus, as we are waiting on God's promises, as we are seeking to identify the places where we are called to participate, you know, where we're called to get into the canoe or the motorboat or take the helicopter, because that's God's provision for us. When we're called into that space to make sure that we are acting wisely, and wisdom is found in other counsel, right? So finding people that we can really trust, who understand the significance of what we're going through, but also with whom we can say, like, I'm really impatient, right? Because that's when it becomes so hard, right? It's only when we think it has to happen now, when we have a sense of urgency that God does not seem to have, and we try to hurry things along. And so I think, you know, making sure that we have good counsel around us, that we're remembering the ways that God has been faithful in the past, and to some degree, not just remembering how God has been faithful in the past, but to think about his timing, right? There's a satirist that I read, Terry Pratchett. And in one of the books, one of the characters is speaking to another, talking to a friend, and basically saying that I just talked big and have no plan. Can you help me come up with a plan? And their friend's response was to say something along the lines of, so you just thought that, you know, the best thing to do was just say something and hope that somebody shows up at the last minute. And his response was, the only way for something to show up at the last minute is for it to be the last minute, right? You got to kind of wait. And so I think we want to be reminded of the timing of God's faithfulness in the past. And then I think we want to be as above board as we possibly can be. And somewhere in that mix, right? Somewhere in that mix, I think we find a way to navigate the impatience that we sometimes feel about God's timing and our own. I don't think it's an easy thing. I don't think that Abram and Sarah, I don't think they did the right thing, but I would not want to judge them too harshly. I think that it was a very complex, difficult situation, but I think, you know, calling on God, remembering what God had already done in their story, those sorts of things I think would have been particularly valuable and beneficial for them in that situation, is beneficial for us now. Let's move on. Question two is this. Given Exodus 33:11, which is the passage that talks about the fact that God would speak to Moses face to face, as with a friend, is this, and I'm assuming this being the story of Hagar, is one of the Old Testament appearances of Jesus. Now, if I'll put it this way, if the word this is referring to the Exodus 33 story, I think my answer still applies. Here's what I mean. It was probably in Bible college many, many years ago now that I first heard the idea that some scholars hold to, that the appearance of the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament was an appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ. So we believe that Jesus was with the Father from the beginning, right? As was the Spirit. But until his incarnation, until he took on flesh, shall we say, he is, he doesn't show up in the Old Testament. And some scholars would suggest that possibly the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Jesus. I suppose I cannot say definitively that it was not. right? I can't say that. I don't really know. I don't think anyone really knows. But in the context of the Old Testament, the figures who encounter the angel of the Lord associate the angel of the Lord so closely with the Lord for us to see that character, that figure, as the Lord himself. And in the Old Testament, because Jesus was yet to come, we have to associate the angel of the Lord primarily, in a Trinitarian sense, with the Father. Looking back, you know, from the perspective of the New Testament, I suppose it is plausible that the angel of the Lord was Jesus in some other form. But in the original telling, that would not have been their response or their answer. The angel of the Lord does appear in a number of places to speak for the Lord and to act for the Lord in such a way that it makes it impossible for us to see the angel of the Lord as an angel, as a messenger, as a delegate or an envoy from the heavens, but someone who is, in reality, so closely associated with the Lord that, so for example, Hagar can say, "I have seen the God who sees me." She's not in any doubt, right? She doesn't say, "Oh, I've been visited by the angel of the God who sees me. I have seen the God who sees me." And I did, I can't remember where I read it. It was in a commentary, actually, just in preparation for the sermon, something that I hadn't really read before. But the idea that the angel of the Lord was a way for the Lord to be perceived and engaged with, that did not include, shall we say, his full glory, right? Because if the Lord appears in all of his glory, as you know, Isaiah saw the train of his robe, not even the fullness of his glory, right? But the glory of the Lord filled the temple and he was just overwhelmed by that. Ezekiel was overwhelmed by a vision of God's throne. And while characters who encounter the angel of the Lord are often, when they realize who it was, are often scared that they're going to die, they don't. And so there's a sense that it's, I'm not sure that it's at all appropriate to say that it's God in disguise, right? But it's God, God in a presentable way, right? He has taken it upon himself to kind of turn the brightness down on his glory, so that he can interact with those who are seeking after him or those with whom he wishes to speak. And I think that's a helpful way to think about it in the Old Testament context. Again, the question of whether it is possibly the pre-incarnate Jesus is I suppose it's up for debate. I know that some scholars would say that it is. Others would want to, I think, suspend a final judgment on that. I think that's where I would sit at this point in time. But it is in the Hagar story, and you find it in other examples as well, that the angel of the Lord has appeared, and it is the Lord, not just a representative of, but someone who can speak on behalf of God and act on behalf of God, and who can be, and who is often received as God himself as well. So, again, if I've got the question right, is this one of the Old Testament appearances of Jesus? I would say, was it yes with a maybe, no with a but? Possibly. In the context of the Old Testament, no. But in the context of the fullness of Scripture, maybe. That's probably as best I can do at this point in time. So the last question kind of caught me by surprise, I'll say. It says, does Galatians 3:16 change how we understand the blessings given to Hagar? And I assumed that the reference was actually what is found in chapter 4 when Paul, writing to the Galatians, to remind them of the wonderful promises that they have in Christ and warning them against returning to Judaism or warning them against specifically about taking on obedience to the law of Moses as part of what it meant to follow after Jesus. And he and Paul uses the example of Hagar and Sarah and of their children, Ishmael and Isaac, to compare and contrast two covenants. The old covenant, represented by Hagar and Ishmael, interestingly enough, and the new covenant, represented by Sarah and Isaac, right? The one who was the fulfillment of the promise. And he uses an allegorical methodology. So Hagar, he says, represents Mount Sinai in Arabia and kind of goes to town on it. It's a curious passage in lots of ways. And that's what I thought the question was in reference to. But it's actually a little bit earlier than that when the passage 3:16 says the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Scripture does not say and to seeds, meaning many people, but and to your seed, meaning one person who is Christ. And so the question then related to that, right, does Galatians 3:16 change how we understand the blessings given to Hagar? And I, would say ultimately no. Paul is using the references to that story, as I said, allegorically, first of all, but as a bit of a symbol of an image, a model and a pattern that the Galatians, the Christians that he's writing to, need to remember and to recall in order to remain and stay faithful to Jesus. But I think the blessings that the Lord gives to Hagar in the context of the Old Testament and the story in Genesis can be taken, we can take them at face value. Ishmael, as we're told a little bit later in Genesis, becomes the father of a whole bunch of tribes and clans, and you know, it's got heaps of descendants, just like the Lord had promised to Hagar. I think that what we find at work in the Genesis account is something I touched on Sunday, that when Hagar flees, she's not just fleeing mistreatment. She's also fleeing from the land where God wanted his people to dwell and from the source of the blessing, which was Abram. And I mentioned in passing that there were a couple of examples where those who even inadvertently, accidentally, quite innocently ended up cursing Abram, doing something that was harmful to him, ended up copying it from the Lord. And those who even, not even inadvertently, but who just decided to move next door, as Lot did, who removed himself from Abram because of his great wealth, his life kind of went to pot afterwards. And so I think that part of what we find in the Hagar story is that God is intent on fulfilling his promise to bless those who bless Abram, right? To curse those who curse him, and to bless all nations through him. So Hagar, for you know all of her lack of agency in the first part of the story, does return of her own free will, and she bears Abram a son. And even though that son is not the son of the promise, that'll be Isaac, it is still nonetheless Abram's firstborn son. That would have been true legally. I suppose it would have been true, you know, biologically. And that is, I suppose, a blessing to Abram. And so she is blessed for that. But she's also an example of the second part of that, the idea that God would bless all nations through Abram. Now, it gets a little bit complicated because, of course, it's from Abraham that the Ishmaelite tribes appear. And then they are a sign of the blessing, and their connection to Abraham is a source of blessing, shall we say. That doesn't get played up much in Scripture. The Ishmaelites and the clans that descended from Ishmael don't really play a particularly significant role in the Old Testament story. They're not They're not allies of God's people, but nor are they necessarily enemies. They play a pretty curiously neutral role in some regards, unlike, say, the Edomites, who are the descendants of Esau, with whom the Israelites did not get along particularly well at all, and they had a very antagonistic relationship. So I think that there's the blessings to Hagar in the story are what we would expect of someone who is associated with and maintains connections with Abram and his household. In chapter 17 of Genesis, the Lord tells Abram that you're going to have a son with Sarah. And Abram, I don't think he really believes that this is going to happen. He just kind of says, listen, that's fantastic, but just bless Ishmael and I'll be happy. And the Lord goes, oh, I'm gonna, but you're still going to have a son with Isaac. And so there's this real sense. And then when Isaac is born and Sarah asks Abram to kind of get rid of Ishmael and Hagar now that there's the real heir on the horizon. Abram is really distressed by that. And so the Lord basically says to him, look, I'm going to bless him. Like, don't worry about him. He's good to go. You can send him away because I have got him. And so I think that's the primary emphasis of the blessing language for Hagar and Ishmael in the Genesis texts. Paul in Galatians is, of course, doing something a little bit different. He is, as I said, warning believers who were being tempted to take on obedience to the law of Moses as part of their following after Jesus. And Paul wants to delineate that the law has been passed over, not superseded, But what Jesus offers now is different, and the law no longer has the same kind of binding effect that it once did. And so he wants to draw attention to the distinctions. And so going back to Abram and talking about his faith that was prior to the law, and then talking about Isaac as the son of the promise rather than Ishmael, who was also a son of Abraham, but not the son of the promise. So he draws on this imagery to make his point. But I don't think that that takes away from the story as we have it in Genesis. I think paying attention to the story as it unfolds, I think is pretty remarkable in and of itself, and draws attention to God's commitment to his promises. To go back to the, I guess, the first question, if Abram and Sarah had just taken a little bit of time, they might have been able to remind themselves of the way in which God's blessing had worked for them. You know, when Sarah had been taken into Pharaoh's harem, you know, not only was she preserved, but Abraham grew like super wealthy and nobody lost their lives. Like, it was just this kind of remarkable situation. When Lot was with Abram, he'd just become exceedingly wealthy, so the land couldn't support them, and had moved on. When the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah and a couple of others were sacked, and Lot and others were taken away, Abram chased them down and won a famous victory over, you know, a bunch of kings and stuff. This sense that God's blessing was there in really evident ways could have reminded them enough to be faithful. In chapter 16, right? Although curiously, there would have been nothing for them to say there's evidence that God can actually give us a child. All they would have been able to draw attention to was the blessings. That disconnect, I think, also makes it hard to trust God. But nonetheless, that's returning to the first question, and we've already answered that. So with that, I will call it, in this case, an afternoon, giving away the time of day here. But then, thank you for those questions. We will probably be back on deck next week, shall we say, at our regular time, trying to return to our Wednesdays as my week returns to normal next week as well. So I look forward to the questions that come from our sermon on Sunday on Rebecca. And then we have a special guest, Melissa Lipset, the week after that, before we jump back into Romans, starting now at the beginning, having worked our way backwards through chapters 12 through 16 and 9 to 11. We now jump back to the start and see how we go. So looking forward to the next term's worth of the Big Three. Trust that's been helpful for you. Thanks again. And until next time, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.